We all learn the hard way that we can miss seeing things in plain sight because it's usually something we need, we don't have much time, and it's right there in front of us, someone else usually points out. We're learning lots over time about our visual perception and its flaws. Our next guest works with people to tune up our use of the sense of sight. Amy Herman is the author of a book called Visual Intelligence: Sharpen Your Perception, Change Your Life. Amy Herman is a lawyer and an art historian, and she combines her skill sets in a course called The Art of Perception, which she has delivered to police departments, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and many corporate clients, among others. Amy Herman, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the basic issue. Humans just don't notice much. I mean, we have our eyes open, but we don't see things. Is that the essence of it?
Yeah, I really try to point out to people that we see so much, but we observe very little. We become a nerd to our surroundings because we want to get from point A to point B. We're multitasking. We have so much to do that we fail to see so often the things that are right in front of our eyes. I like to say there are things that are hiding in plain sight.
I've talked to neuroscientists about this in the past. How much do we screen out?
You know, we have so many filters. Our brain just can't handle all the information that's coming in. And I think we've made so many decisions. We've decided what filters we need and what filters we don't need. And I think there's a tremendous amount of information that is just going right by us. We get what we think we need, and we're missing a lot of the detail and the nuance of what's happening in the world around us. It's kind of scary sometimes. And, you know, I see it through a professional filter because I work with cops and surgeons and people in emergency medicine. And for them, it's a matter of life and death. But for the rest of us, it may not be that extreme. But what kinds of clues are we missing in our kids' behavior? Or when something is amiss, I fear that there's a lot just passing us by.
Oh, a lot of afterthoughts about how did I not notice X, whatever X was.
Exactly. How many times do you say to someone, how did I miss that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly combining your own skill sets here, but how did you hit upon the idea of works of art as tests for visual perception?
It sounds like such a strange combination, so I find myself having to explain it to people. I started the program back in 2000, and the original concept was not my idea. There was this great collaboration at the Yale Center for British Art and Yale Medical School, where they would bring medical students, take them out of the hospital and out of a clinical setting, and bring them to an art museum to teach them to analyze works of art in the hopes that when they got back to the hospital, they would be better observers of their patients. So with Yale's permission, I started a version of that program at the Frick Collection in New York City. And about 3 years later, I had this epiphany that there's much greater applicability than just for the medical community. And I called the NYPD and I said, I've got this great idea. Would you send cops to the museum because I think they need good observation skills, and I think looking at works of art can really help them do their job. And the police department was a real visionary. They heard it, they saw it, and 6 months later, all the new captains in the NYPD had to take the training, and it's expanded from there.
Well, with all the police agencies, I'm thinking you probably start with at least a few skeptics in the room.
More than a few. Mm-hmm. I can see from their body language when their arms are crossed and they're sitting in a classroom in a museum thinking, first of all, what am I doing here? And second of all, what's this woman going to teach me? You know, she's not a cop. She's not a surveillance agent. And I watch the transformation. The arms come down. The hands eventually go up. And they realize I'm not teaching art substantively. I'm not teaching them about, you know, Picasso versus Pollock. I'm using art as data. A new kind of data that they've never seen before, and yet they have to use the exact same skills that they use on the job when looking at works of art. And it's so gratifying for me to see that light bulb go on over their heads thinking, oh my gosh, looking at works of art, it really does apply to what I do every day on the job.
There's art and there's art. I mean, you know, there are still lives with, you know, fruit in bowls and stacks of hay and things like that. And then art where there are relationships with people. There's something going on in the picture. Are either one of those more effective than the other?
You know, I try to use a wide variety so people never get bored. So sometimes I'll use a still life to illustrate that. You know, sometimes we see the same things over and over again, and do we notice what changes? And then I use photography from yesterday. I use contemporary photographs that are evocative and thought-provoking, and sometimes, quite candidly, difficult to look at because, you know, professionals in the intelligence community and law enforcement don't have the option to look away. And so I use art as the vehicle to show them things that make them uncomfortable, things they don't understand, and even things they don't like, with the idea that they'll be able to talk more easily about it after learning to discuss it in the context of art. So I try to use landscapes and portraits and photography and sculpture. I try to use as much as possible. It keeps it really interesting.
Amy Herman's course on teaching people how to sharpen their visual acuity is called The Art of Perception. Her book about it is called Visual Intelligence, Sharpen Your Perception, Change Your Life. You're welcome to get in on this conversation. Maybe you have a story about your own perceptions in the world or your view of art. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Amy, you start the book with photographs. Do we get different things from photographs versus paintings, for example?
Well, I find that with 99% of the participants who take my course don't have a background in art. You know, most of them have not studied art, and many of them have never even been to a museum. So for some of them, photography is more accessible, more visually accessible than painting or sculpture. So sometimes I'll start with photography to get their feet wet. You know, dip your toes in the water, learn to talk about these photographs, and then we work into paintings, and then we work into sculpture. And by the end of the class, some of these people are like born art historians. They realize that it's about their critical inquiry. It's about their ability to ask questions about what they're looking at and not so much who painted the painting and when did they do it.
So they're supposed to draw some inferences from what they're seeing.
Well, I try to make the distinction. Mm-hmm. Early on in the class, I define observation, perception, mm-hmm. and inference. And I tell them that their perceptions of a situation or a problem or a crime or a patient, their perceptions are informed by observations of the five senses, and their inferences need to be informed by their perceptions. And sometimes we don't have enough information to make the leap from perception to inference. So I want them to be sure and to keep those inferences in check and make sure that when they have to make them, they have enough information. And if they don't, to make note of the fact that I may not have enough information to make this inference, and I'm going to be careful about doing it.
It's especially critical, I think, that you do this with captured moments in time, which is what art is.
That's exactly right.
In the sense that you could see one person standing over another and say, well, the guy standing up killed the guy who's on the floor. That may not be the case.
That's exactly right. And the overarching goal for me is to make sure that the participants in my class and the readers of my book recognize and acknowledge that no two people see anything the same way, and that you could be at the same crime scene, in the same operating room, or at the same corporate board meeting, and two people can walk away with fundamentally different perceptions of what they just saw.
Wow. And those are the situations where you say, what do you mean? No, this is totally the other guy did it. Can't you see that?
The perfect example I can give you is that blue dress. Or that dress that was put up on Facebook about a year and a half ago. This woman in the UK bought a dress to wear in a wedding, and she put it up on Facebook and said, what color is my dress? And I show the dress in my classes. 60% of the people see that dress as white and gold, and the rest see it as blue and black. And they can't believe that the person sitting next to them sees it as an entirely different color scheme. And the truth is, I don't worry about a dumb dress on Facebook. I worry about real-life situations when we perceive things so fundamentally different from a person standing next to us.
Do we happen to know actually what the original color of the dress was?
I believe it's blue and black.
Okay. How much does it influence the interpretation or the observation or the perception at its basic level to know the name of a work of art, for example?
Well, one of the things that I do when my classes are held in museums, I don't allow the participants to read the label that's next to the work of art, not before they look at it and before they talk about it to their colleagues, for the very simple reason it feeds into your bias. Mm-hmm. If you read a label next to a work of art, you're going to look for what that label tells you to look for. And what I want these participants to realize is they have a very strong inherent sense of observation, and I want them to use that first, see what their own observations are, what do they notice about the painting, and then read the label, because there's always time to get more information. It's analogous to when a doctor walks into a patient's room. Before you pick up the chart and read what the night nurse has written, just look at your patient. Take a look at them with your eyes. What does the room smell like? What does their voice sound like? Then read all the medical information and the x-rays and the diagnostics, because the best technology we have is a pair of eyes. And people don't realize they're afraid to use that, and they reach for technology and or labels first.
The art that you use in this course, is it something like 1,000 different pieces you have that you can go to?
I have an archive of, yes, thousands of works of art that I use in a PowerPoint presentation, and I really try to select the works of art that not only are conducive to the best conversation, but will have maximum relevance and applicability for the particular work or group that I'm working with.
All right, so it is tailored to the audience you're training.
Absolutely.
Okay. In the book, you start with a native of Uganda, Derek Kayongo. I mean, he wasn't looking at art, but he noticed something else. This is a really interesting story.
Yeah, I love the story of Derek Kayongo because it illustrates not only seeing the big picture, but thinking about what you see and then doing something about it. He is an immigrant from Uganda, and he was staying in a hotel in the United States. And when he left the hotel room for the day and came back at the end of the day, he went into the bathroom, and he saw that the soap in the shower had been replaced by a brand new soap in a box. Now, for those of us that stay in hotels here all the time, we're very used to the toiletries being replaced for us. And he took the box of soap, and he ran down to the front desk in the hotel, and he said, "Where's the old soap that I used?" And they said, "Well, we replaced it for you. You have a brand new bar." And Derek said, "But I don't want to be charged for a new bar of soap." And they said, "No, we do it, you know, it's complimentary." And then he asked the key question, "What did you do with my bar of soap that was in the shower this morning?" And he said, "We threw it away." And Derek went up to his room and he cried because he realized what a rare, rare resource soap was in his home country of Uganda. And he thought, what a waste. In every hotel room across the country in the United States, barely used bars of soap were being discarded as trash. And he started the Global Soap Project, which enabled people to recycle all that used soap, sanitize it, and distribute it to countries where soap is so rare. And it had such a profound impact on the rate of disease and hygiene. And it really made a difference, all from one observation that we all take for granted, that soap in a hotel room was being replaced.
Then there's a story of Alexander Graham Bell, who really helped us communicate with each other a lot quicker. He gave an admission later in life about things that he had been inattentive about. What was his story?
Yeah, he also, I mean, we think of someone who has so many patents and so many discoveries, somebody as famous as Alexander Graham Bell, who readily admitted that he had been walking around his family's land with his eyes basically closed, that he didn't see certain attributes of the landscape. And what's so counterintuitive about that is we think of someone as, you know, like Alexander Graham Bell, as seeing and embracing everything. And the best feedback that I've gotten from readers of this book, they tell me, "You know, Amy, I thought I was perceptive. I thought I was a really observant person. And your book opened my eyes, and I didn't even realize that they were closed."
Some of this is evolutionary, though, isn't it? I mean, we get to a point where if it can't eat us or we can't eat it, we tend to ignore it. Is that ultimately what we're dealing with here?
I think that has a lot to do with it, but I think something else that feeds into this is the idea of multitasking and disruptive technologies. You know, we have so many sources of information. We have our iPhones, and we have texting and emails, and we have constant news sources and instant feeds. And I think that we're processing so much information that not only do we lose the ability to observe versus see, we've lost the ability to prioritize. I have a whole chapter in the book called Urgent versus Important, and we're losing that distinction between what's urgent and what's important.
Well, okay, distraction's one thing, but you also talk about being in a crowded metro station in Washington, and it made me remember that we avoid sometimes looking at things and people in some situations. And in those crowds, for example, how do we be curious and yet not be the person who gets hit up for spare change?
Exactly. So the case to which you're referring, I was in the metro station in Washington, and I happened to notice, because I do this for a living, I'm standing on the platform, and I saw an emotionally disturbed man standing on the platform, and he was talking to himself and ranting and raving, and he had a sharp object in his hand, and he was digging the sharp object into his hand. And when the train pulled in, I moved to the other end of the platform and got into a completely different car, and no fewer than a dozen people got into the car with this man. And I thought to myself, why would you willingly get into a metro car, especially with all the problems metro's having now, why would you get into a metro car with this clearly emotionally disturbed man? And I looked at all those people, and they were so absorbed in their phones and their technology and talking on the phone that they didn't even realize who was around them. And you're right, you don't want to be, this is a matter of situational awareness and personal safety. And I think we have forfeited a lot of our own situational awareness because of these distractions in our life.
So we have about a minute left. Can you just give us the one main thing we need to know just to be able to sort of reframe things and reset our perception?
Absolutely. The biggest thing that I ask people to do, it's not so much about what you see and what you perceive. It's what you might be missing. And I encourage everyone, collaborate, ask, talk to other people, and say, here's my situation. Is there something I might be missing? Because the bottom line is multiple perspectives make for better decision-making and greater visual intelligence.
We can learn a lot from this. The book is called Visual Intelligence, Sharpen Your Perception, Change Your Life. It's by Amy Herman, who's lawyer and art historian, and combines those in her course called The Art of Perception. Amy, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.